All rise.
Be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 040332, Bed Bath & Beyond versus Eureka.
I told the earlier audience if they would stay, I would do the juggling. That's better things to do, but it wasn't very interesting. Or argument, I pray, this would be happening. We're here today to ask this court to correct the mistake made by the Court of Appeals, and also to take this opportunity to reemphasize the role of review of harmless error, where what role does it play in the administration of justice in Texas? We are of the opinion that the Court of Appeals erred in applying the Castile rule to this set of facts, and thereby reaching a conclusion that there had to be and should be automatic reversible error. Instead, these facts, which I will discuss with your permission momentarily, calls out for a harmless error rule on the record in its entirety. And once that is done, this court would come to the conclusion, in my opinion, that nothing that was that the conclusion of the instruction unavoidable accident in this broad form single theory of liability sufficient caused the rendition of an improper verdict, nor does it prevent the litigant from presenting to this court its claim of error.
You think it was error?
Your Honor, personally, I do not, and for the reason that the plaintiff injected the case himself. One will recall the defense never injected, talked about unavoidable accident until the closing argument. The counsel for the plaintiff cross-examined witnesses on that as part of his cross-examination on the pleadings. Nevertheless, Your Honor, I do no service to this court unless I emphasize this. The issue that we bring to you, which I think is good for the jurisprudence of the state, is to let's assume that it was error, although I personally do not believe that. But even if it were error, what do you do in a situation where you have an erroneous, improper instruction in a broad form, single liability issue? Do you apply Castile or do you apply Reinhart theories of analysis? And, of course, we say it must be Reinhart. It should be a review of the record in its entirety. Now, the facts in this case. The facts in this case, this was an incredibly unbelievable case in chief. The case was so unbelievable that the defense did not even present any witnesses on the button, did not present any witnesses on its fading of the case. This is the case where the plaintiff was caught. Plaintiff's counsel was caught encouraging the treating, testifying doctor to change his records, which he did, to make all medical records reflect that the patient's problems were related to the Bed Bath & Beyond accident, not as the records had previously indicated from the workers' compensation claim, auto accident, and other instances of lung trauma. That, in and of itself, in Harris County, is a non-starter. That is the type of evidence that the jury says, where is the on-off switch? Let me out of here, which is what they did do on this threshold issue, this first issue, which was a combined negligence, proximate causation, broad form submission. But it didn't stop there. Mrs. Eureka would make statements, which I will not dwell on here because they are in the record which you have read, but she would make statements in long speeches, and then when on cross-examination, trapped, caught, would simply change her testimony as if it meant nothing. Oh, yes, that's the way it happened. There were other instances that were embarrassing during the trial.
But without going through the factual analysis, yeah. I mean, giving deference to the record as we have to, in Castile and Harris, we pretty much said that you're entitled to a trial on correct theory of law. And if an incorrect instruction is given, why does that not become a possible incorrect theory?
Well, because we think that Castile, you dealt with a broad form submission with multiple theories of recovery. And if that were reversed and sent back, presumably on retrial, the appellate, the trial judge would say, well, we'll submit separate issues on these liability theories. You reverse this case and send it back, you can't submit an issue on unavoidable accident, can you? It's an inferential rebuttal issue that can only be done by instruction. No, Your Honor, we say, and I say it here to you, the court respectfully today, we ask you that in situations involving alleged erroneous instructions, and I have my private view whether this was an improper instruction, but for the bench and the bar, let's assume that it was, for an improper instruction in a single issue, single liability theory, broad form submission, except in very few circumstances, the rule ought to be that it is governed by a harmless error analysis, where you review the entire record.
What would be the exceptions?
Well, I think where you have, in Romero, in the Romero case, where you have such a directive, instructions that were so directive, that I think that might be done by,
Isn't this instruction covered by Dillard versus Texas Electric?
We think, well, yes, sir, it could be. It could be. This instruction...
I mean, why is this instruction wrong?
Well...
Only because this court has said it applies just to children and weather, even though, in fact, the instruction says nothing about children and weather.
Well, that's true. And, of course, we disagree strongly with the concept that unavoidable accident in the context of this case is improper, Your Honor, because they objected it. And furthermore, the instruction is a mere... aid to the jury. It modifies slightly the meaning of negligence, and it modifies slightly and helps the jury understand proximate causation. It is a helpful aid. And in all 254 counties, trial judges believe that. They think it's good to give instructions. That's what they were taught. I, being 62 years old, remember that. The court's telling the trial judges, more instructions the better, buddy. Go with it. And so now we are reaching a situation where if there is an instruction and it is even a modicum, it is marginally incorrect, and the appellate court wants to apply the Castile reasoning, then you have an automatic reversal, and then you have another trial. No, no, no. We say common sense and good management dictate that where it is a broad form submission with a single theory of recovery, as here, negligence, and a complaint of instruction or definition, then and in that event.
But the instruction is a matter of avoidance, and so if it's an improper matter of avoidance, how do you separate that out from Castile?
Respectfully, I do not think that unavoidable accident
Presuming it were incorrect. Presuming it were an incorrect avoidance theory.
Yes. Well, I did say a few minutes ago that there might be some circumstances in which one would deviate from the hard and fast rule and instruction. In a single issue, broad form submission must be judged by harmless error analysis. The Romero circumstances, if that's not to think of that type, if you have that circumstance where there is an avoidance theory submitted, usually it's a theory, not an instruction. And a theory is a lot different than an instruction, because if the instruction encapsulates or sets up a theory, then you get more to Castile, where you had battling theories within one context, and you don't know whether six went one way or six went the other. But where it's just an instruction, kind of a definition and an aid, then I think that I'm correct, frankly, and that it should be judged by a harmless error analysis. If you had a situation, and we can all dream them up, where the instruction sets up a theory, then you have a different case and you might reach a different result, but not here.
Apart from your whether you believe that it's a proper instruction or not, based on their bringing it into the case, what is the evidence that this accident was caused by the negligence of no party to the case?
Well, when, first of all, this is there were all kinds of things going on that were being discussed, whether there was vibration, whether there was air conditioning ducts. People in these stores, like they vibrated shelves taking stuff off of them. Indeed, the plaintiff's description of the accident, where the merchandise all came tumbling down like a waterfall. There was more going on here than just one trash can or two trash cans falling. So we didn't know. But when it came time for the charge conference, the judge did what good judges have always done. They injected it into the case. It was pled, and it was considered good practice to submit the issue because it did aid the jury in understanding the context of the facts. The Bed Bath & Beyond position was there was an employee up there behind it, but it's unclear that he was that he committed negligent conduct that was a proximate cause of the occurrence in question. And that was the point that the Court of Appeals missed. They just came to the conclusion that gravity decided the case. And gravity meant negligence. Gravity somehow meant that the case was over. And what we tried to say is that we don't think that the definition and instruction was necessarily error, but let's just assume that it was for the purpose of this appeal, because you all are writing a lot on this topic, and everybody out here is seeing that you're writing. You wrote as recently as May in Romero, so you're writing a lot on this charge and issue, and we're here to do our part to present a good, clean whack at it. And my position, repeated, is that where it is a single issue brought forward submission with an instruction only, a good rule would be that the harmless error analysis is the one which should be used.
But it has to depend, based on what you've just told us, it has to depend on what the instruction is. We're going to always have to divine the instruction, aren't we? Because some instructions actually tell the jury what to do.
How true that
and
is.
Some instructions, such as this, simply someone could view it as the other side of proximate cause and not so harmful. But how are we going to help the bench and the bar and the judges try cases if we start separating those out, or is it going to be of more help if we say it's up to you as a lawyer, up to you as a lawyer, to make sure your instructions are right, and so that on appeal it can be looked at, and if you can't do it right, then you're running the risk of having the case reversed. So putting the burden on the lawyer to say, if this is questionable, I better not put it in there.
Well, we like to think it's a combination of both, frankly, Your Honor. It is the lawyers working with the judge. But you left, like, even in the Romero case, I read you have left open, even under the Castile analysis, this court has left open what I call, frankly, what we call the escape hatch, to cover situations in which you wanted to review certain definitions. In Romero, you said, no reversal is merited, even under a Castile analysis, if the appellate court is, I quote, reasonably certain that the jury was not significantly influenced by issues erroneously submitted. Even in Romero, you made that clear. You wrote it. We believe it. So now, insofar as lawyers making mistakes, yes, lawyers do make mistakes, but in this context, the only way the attorney for Bed Bath & Beyond could have solved this problem would have been to do what? To submit the same issue twice, once with unavoidable accident as instruction and once without. And you do not want us to do that. In the long run, you do not want us to do that. We can't. There's case law that says you can't submit duplicative issues like that. You shouldn't. We'll get back at like it was in the 50. I've given speeches. I call it Back to the Future, where we have 50 issues on a simple auto accident. No, the system that...
Would your answer be different if you could fashion this as a separate question? Question number two, do you find that this was an unavoidable accident? Answer yes or no. If you could do that, would your answer be different?
If, I think this could sound flippant, if we went back prior to Yarbrough versus Berner and we could submit that, yes, my answer would be different. Yeah, it would. If inferential rebuttal issues could be submitted as defensive issues, of course my argument would change, and I would not be making it. But the reality is that's not the way it is. And on instructions, on inferential rebuttal matters, those that are included in the full charge, the analysis should be of the entire record. And as I conclude, let's look at the entire record. I've touched on it first. I hesitate to dwell too much on evidence, but it's very important to look at the evidence in this case because it was a prima facie evidence case. The court pointed out that the court said erroneously there was a sharp difference of evidence. No, there wasn't. The defense counsel offered no evidence on this case in chief because the prima facie case was so weak. I say this to you, respectfully. Just because lawyers yell at one another doesn't mean that the evidence is sharply contradictory. Lawyers yell at one another when they agree on the facts, whether that rises to the level of a prima facie case. That's what happened here. The case was over when they wrestled. I mean, when the plaintiff wrestled. And that became, that's what Justice Jennings was earnestly pointing out.
Well, there was some evidence that an employee knocked the trash cans off.
Yes.
And so then that would be some evidence if a juror decided it was ordinarily prudent, employees wouldn't do that, and it, but it wouldn't be overwhelming evidence if jurors could decide that even ordinarily prudent employees sometimes knock the trash cans off.
Exactly.
So just a jury question, the jury said no.
My time has expired. I will reserve my 5 minutes for my rebuttal.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jonathan S. Stoder will present argument for the respondent. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Stoder and I represent the plaintiff and the respondent in this case, Rafael Arista. I want to begin my presentation by touching on a couple of the facts in response to what the petitioner has said today, and then I want to move into Castile and then talk about the Reinhart unavoidable accident theory. This was a negligent activity case. Rafael Arista was shopping at a Bed Bath & Beyond store with his wife and children. They were standing next to a 12-foot-high shelf looking at items. They had just purchased a house when all of a sudden Mr. Arista described trash cans, glassware, other items just came raining down from the shelf and knocked Mr. Arista unconscious. I don't think that Bed Bath & Beyond really ever disputed what happened here, that the items fell off the shelf. They prepared an accident report on the day of the incident, and this was prepared by the store management. They said that items came raining down, came down off the shelf and hit Mr. Arista. So I think that that point was pretty much admitted at trial. The crucial evidence came from David Traxler, who was the store manager. He testified at trial as the corporate representative.
Mr. Sargent, let me ask you, the premise of Castile and Harris County versus Smith, I think, was that you could separate out these questions and ask them separately, so that if you wanted to challenge something on appeal, you could do that. But you can't parse out inferential rebuttal issues separately. So why wouldn't we say then that the Castile analysis doesn't apply? Or do you agree it doesn't apply? And then we just move into simply the question of was there or was there not harmless error?
I agree under Rule 277, of course, you cannot submit an inferential rebuttal instruction as a separate question. But I think that just as in other areas of law, you have to balance and weigh competing rules and policies. I mean, I think all the time we have competing rules of constitutional law or statutory law that may clash. And in this case, as was stated in Castillo, when you ask two theories in the same question, one of which was later invalid.
And you could have easily separated it out.
Yes.
That was a key piece of both of those opinions, that, you know, something that if you have questions about the evidence to support something, it's possible to separate it out to avoid error. Here, when you can't, doesn't that just take you out of the Castile analysis entirely?
I don't think it does, because I think, again, the court should engage in a balancing of the two competing interests. On the one hand, you have the plaintiff who has the right to pursue a meaningful appeal. And I think under the Castile analysis, that right to appeal is denied when you mix two theories together. On the other hand, of course, you have the defense that has the right to submit inferential.
What's improper about this instruction?
I think that what's improper is that there was no evidence of an unavoidable accident that occurred in this case. And Reinhart and the previous case.
Do you agree? Well, it is true. We've said it's only weather and children.
Yes.
But that's not what the instruction says.
Well,
under the instruction, if an employee did it, but the employee was acting as an ordinary prudent person, it was just an accident, that instruction would fit just perfectly.
Well, I don't think that, you know, I don't see how an employee could knock merchandise off a shelf and not be negligent.
So every time you knock something over, you're acting as an unordinarily prudent person.
Well, I think the court has also said...
That's a yes or no. Every time you knock something over, you are not acting as an ordinarily prudent person because, of course, ordinarily prudent people never knock anything over. Is that right?
I think that
There's more to the instruction, though, than just whether.
We'll answer that one first.
Well,
don't ordinarily prudent people sometimes knock a water glass over?
I think that that could happen, but if I could get back to the court's definition of unavoidable accident, and the court has said that it's normally used to inquire about circumstances where you have a non-human.
But we said in Dillard, the question is, was the jury misled? And the jurors haven't read Reinhardt. They don't know that technically this is a misuse of this instruction. All they know is the instruction. And the instruction just says.
And even if they had read Reinhardt, we, at least part of that opinion says that the instructions used to make sure jurors understand that they don't have to necessarily find either party negligent, which is just true, right?
The jurors don't, but also this court has said, and if I could turn to the Select Insurance case versus Boucher, the court said, you know, in that case that, you know, what we're dealing with here is an inferential rebuttal instruction, and I think that what the court has emphasized as far as inferential rebuttal instruction is more than just a negative of the, you know, of the plaintiff's case, that it's actually a separate legal theory in and of itself. So that it's more in that circumstance under Select Insurance Company versus Boucher than just a flat general denial of the plaintiff's case. This court has treated it actually as a separate legal theory in and of itself.
But you were going to say that it was important to balance interests.
Yes.
And so I was wondering how those should be balanced when in some instances the plaintiff or the defendant can submit all the issues they want to. They just can't put them together when there's no basis for something. So it's just a question of form, not a question of are you going to get an answer from the jury. You're going to get an answer. You're going to get a fact. And the only question is, are we going to put it all under one Arabic numeral, or are we going to put it under several? And so that's one situation. And the other situation is there's nothing we can do about this. There's no other way to submit it other than just not submitting it at all.
Well,
don't those strike you as different situations?
I think that, again, if I could get back to the balancing here, I think the plaintiff certainly has an obligation to be judged on a correct jury charge that states the law and the instructions and the definitions of the questions. If you balance that against the defendant's right to submit inferential rebuttal instructions and defenses, I think in this case, under Castile, the plaintiff's rights outweigh the defendant's rights. Basically what the defendants are saying.
What I'm getting is the right, if there is one, in Castile, the focus of the dispute is just the form, not the substance. The substance is going to the jury no matter what. So we're only talking about how. Here, we're talking about whether they're going to see it or not. And it seems to me it's harder to have a per se reversal rule when you have that situation than it is when all you're talking about is the form. But I'm interested in your thought.
I think, if I get back to the balancing, I think the plaintiff's rights in this situation outweigh the defendant's rights. Basically what the defendant is saying, they have a right to get it wrong and still be judged on a reversible error standard on appeal, on a harmless error standard on appeal. There was another option that I thought of. I thought I would bring to the attention of the court, and I haven't seen any Texas case law on this, but I know, Justice Hecht, you cited the DuPont de Nemours case versus Berkeley in your decision in Romero. And as I read that case, this was a patent infringement case. The jury returned a general verdict for the defendant on infringement. The court submitted a separate interrogatory asking the jury whether their decision was based solely on the issue of obviousness, which they said no. I think that could be an option for the court. I haven't seen any cases or any rules that would prohibit Texas practice from submitting interrogatory questions asking about the basis for a verdict. So I think that could be an option in this circumstance. If I could get back to the questions at hand, I'd move on at this point to the Reinhart standard, and I'd like to argue as to why the Court of Appeals was also correct in determining that the case should be reversed because the unavoidable accident instruction was harmless. I mean, was harmful. What the court said is that under Rule 44.1A1, the unavoidable accident instruction probably caused a rendition of improper judgment. What the court said was that this was a highly contested case. The question arises to whether the verdict was against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. One of Bed Bath & Beyond's main contentions at trial was that accidents happen, a close analog to the unavoidable accident theory, and that Bed Bath & Beyond emphasized the argument during its summation. The main authorities, of course, that the court relied on were Reinhart versus Young and Uchol versus HEB Food Stores. This case was not like Reinhart, as the Court of Appeals said, because this is a situation where the defendant did not introduce ample evidence to support the jury's failure to find him negligent. And one of the points that the...
So was the trial judge required to instruct a verdict in your favor? As a matter of law, the defendant was negligent.
In this case, what we say, obviously, is there was a genuine issue of material fact as
which
to
was
Bed Bath & Beyond was negligent in knocking the items on the top of Mr.
And your Reese. Position is there's no evidence that anybody other than the Bed Bath defendant employee did it. So the jury question is whether just because you did it means it's negligent.
No, there's more evidence, and we did not plead res ipsa loquitur in this case. But here, Mr. Urista, after the incident happened, walked around to the back of the shelf. She saw Reginald Neal, who was a store employee, standing on top of the ladder on the other side of the shelf using a broom to manipulate merchandise to try and take the trash can down. So that, in our opinion, in and of itself is evidence of Bed Bath & Beyond.
Can we focus just for a moment on what the actual instruction says and what it's telling the jury? It's telling them essentially that you don't have to find, just because this case was brought in this court and you've heard this evidence, that doesn't mean you have to say the plaintiff was negligent or Bed Bath & Beyond was negligent. You decide based on the evidence yourself. What is wrong with that instruction? I mean, the lawyers could have said that without an instruction, right?
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think in Reinhart, in the pre-existing case law, that line before, they said that there has to be some evidence there has to be affirmative evidence.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is why would we stick with that when the jury is being told something that is absolutely true? They can look at this evidence. They can find, as long as there's some evidence, find the plaintiff, the defendant negligent. But they don't have to. There's nothing that conclusively requires them to find Bed Bath & Beyond negligent in this case, right?
Well, we did not argue with the form of the question. We argued with the substance that it should not have been submitted.
Well, I'm talking about the substance of the question, exactly what it tells the jury. What is wrong with telling the jury the absolute truth?
I think in this situation that the instruction itself, under select instruction, well, this instruction itself is an inferential rebuttal defense. If the court looks at Select Insurance Company versus Boucher, the court traced the history of inferential rebuttal instructions, and it said that this is more than just a general negative. This is more than just a general denial of the plaintiff's case. This is actually a separate factual theory. So I think the court would have to look at the substance and the history of inferential rebuttal instructions itself to answer that question. But to get back to Your Honor, we did not object to the form of the question. It was a substance that it should not have been given in this case. If I could return back to the matter of hand and return to the Reinhart analysis, there was not ample evidence offered to support the jury's failure to find the defendant negligent. I'm sorry, the defendant did not offer evidence to exonerate itself of negligence, and the defense claims that somehow puts a burden of proof on them, and we do not believe that that's true. This court observed in the Weinhardt case that some evidence was offered, and I think that that would tend to blunt the effect of an improper, unavoidable accident instruction if the evidence is just so completely overwhelming that the defendant was not negligent. I think that would tend to blunt the effect of an improper instruction. Here,
does the evidence have to be so overwhelming, or can there be just some evidence for it to be submitted?
I think it could be some evidence. I mean, here there really was no evidence to exonerate themselves of negligence that was offered.
But you were still applying Castile to a case that was more factually similar to Reinhardt. You say Castile still applies even in that situation.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that Castile applies. Our argument certainly is that Castile applies as the Court of Appeals found, but also, alternatively, that Reinhardt itself, when under the Reinhardt analysis, the instruction was harmful also. So we're arguing both points.
Your whole argument depends upon the propriety of the instruction in the first instance. And in Dillard, didn't we say that this type of instruction is proper by its own terms?
I must say, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the Dillard case, and I apologize for that. I'd be happy to.
Well, we say that in Dillard, we've previously said that it ordinarily applies to fog, snow, sleet, non-human conditions, things like that. But we specifically said that the instruction itself is not so limited, and therefore it could be used to say that it just was nobody's fault. And if that is the case, if the instruction was not improper, we don't get into Castile.
Yeah, obviously, if the instruction itself was proper, then you wouldn't reach the harmful error standards. We argue that it was not a proper instruction because there was absolutely no evidence of a non-human event that caused this incident.
But that language is not included in the instruction.
The proximate, yes.
No, but I mean the inferential rebuttal instruction, unavoidable accident, doesn't require that it be a non-human event.
No, but I think
so. The jury wouldn't know that.
The jury itself, I think based on the instruction, should not have found that there was an unavoidable accident, which I think is what they did in this case. But we still feel that the instruction itself should have never been given in the first place, and we objected in the trial court that there was no evidence of an unavoidable accident, and argued that it should not have been given, and that nudged and tilted the jury to reach its decision. If I could get back to the Weinhardt analysis itself, here there was no accompanying instruction like in Weinhardt, where there was a sudden emergency instruction that was given that reiterated most of the substance of the unavoidable accident instruction. Also, the Court of Appeals found that the jury may very well have relied on the instruction in this case. Neither party really disputed that Reginald Neal was standing atop the ladder and caused the trash cans to fall. Fourth, Bed Bath & Beyond emphasized the theory during its closing argument. At one point, it spoke about the reasons why the jury should find against the plaintiff, but then it said, and more importantly, this was not an unavoidable. This was an unavoidable accident. So we believe that in this case, the emphasis that the defense placed on that instruction, when they said that this was the most important reason the jury should find against the plaintiff, in this case, shows that the jury relied on that. The case itself here is more like the Uecker decision than it is Reinhardt, and that's what the Court of Appeals found in Uecker. This was a case where a grocery store customer slipped and fell in a puddle of children's bubble blowing solution. The case went to trial. The judge submitted an unavoidable accident instruction. The Court of Appeals found that the instruction was improper and also that it was harmful in the sense that this was a close question as to whether the verdict against the plaintiff was against the great weight preponderance of the evidence. We feel like the facts in this case mirror those of Uecker. and that, therefore, the vehicle case should control the outcome. If there are no more questions from the court, I would just conclude by asking the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. If the court determines that the judgment should be reversed for any reason, we ask that the case in that circumstance be remanded to consider our other points of error which were presented to the Court of Appeals. We presented other issues that weren't addressed by the Court of Appeals, but we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed and that the case be remanded to the trial court for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Even if Ryan Hart could be properly distinguished from the facts of this case, I think it's important. The principle of Ryan Hart is what is important. The principle of Ryan Hart is that where you have a single issue, broad form submission, with an alleged erroneous instruction, that is a situation that cries out for a review of the entire record to determine whether there has been harmful error. The trial counsel for Bed Bath & Beyond, goofy though he may be, probably would be surprised that he was thought to be emphasizing unavoidable accident when he uttered 70 words about it in a 5,000-word summation and never talked about it on the case in chief, period. There were 25 lines out of a 27-page final summation devoted 5 lines, 70 words, to unavoidable accident, and indeed, when one reads those rather indirect references, it appears to be sort of a plea, an appeal to common sense. Sometimes I see license plates as I drive down the street saying, blank happens to some of these license plates. It's sort of a variation of that. Things happen sometimes. It doesn't mean anyone was negligent. It just happened. And that is essentially what the jury heard from the mouth of counsel for Bed Bath & Beyond on the occasion in question. Emphasizing it? I don't think so. Unconscious. Mr. Urista, we are told, was unconscious. This was another singular fact that begged credibility. He said there was, this was an unwitnessed testimony, except by the wife. He said that he was knocked unconscious by this avalanche of material that showered down. He fell down on the floor unconscious. And what happened? A sales associate walked out, saw him lying on the floor, and then went back to waiting on a customer. That doesn't happen in America in the first part of the 21st century. And you try to tell a jury that, it's going to be another non-starter, of which there were plenty in this case. This is a threshold issue case. It was the only opportunity for the jury to make its opinion known quickly and decisively. Admittedly, it was a 10-2 verdict. But we do not know whether, why that's relevant even under Reinhardt, whereas here the evidence was so fractured and unbelievable. It is true that no evidence was offered, while evidence was offered in Reinhardt. The frightening, or rather annoying, suggestion by the Court of Appeals is that it seems to imply that defense counsel in cases in the future must put on some testimony and offer some evidence when the plaintiff's case in chief essentially is the moon is made of green cheese. Where the theory of recovery is the moon is made of green cheese, the defense should not have to do anything except sit down. I feel like I have spoken dogmatically enough. Unless there are other questions, I will ask permission to retire.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.